Thank you for joining us. Caring about your world and doing the next right and honorable thing. I'm so pleased to have James Corbett join us again. He does what is called the Corbett Report. It's an independent, listener-supported, alternative news source. It operates on the principle of open-source intelligence. Don't we love that? And provides podcasts, interviews, articles, and videos about breaking news and important issues from 9/11 truth, false flag terror, to the Big Brother police state, eugenics, geopolitics, central banking fraud, all the kinds of stuff the Power Hour is interested in, and more. James Corbett's been living and working in Japan since 2004. He also writes for and does the International Forecaster newsletter. And his website, CorbettReport.com. That's Corbett with two T's, CorbettReport.com. Thank you so very much, James, for joining us in the Power Hour today.
Well, thank you for having me on again, Joyce. It's always a pleasure to be here with you and your audience.
Well, it is a pleasure to have you shed your insight into what we see happening. This thing with China is really, I think, starting to be an issue. Now, I don't think it's just good cop, bad cop any longer. I think it's creating, it's kind of fulminating into something, you know, with the fiscal issue of pulling back on the, using the U.S. reserve dollar, and then also on demanding that we file flight plans over the disputed area. What is your thoughts about what's going on in China?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, it certainly couldn't be denied any longer, if there was anyone out there who was denying it, that China is beginning to show signs that they are going to start throwing their weight around on the geopolitical scale, on the geoeconomic scale, in some of the other ways as well, including military. And of course, the one that's been grabbing the headlines in the last few days has been the Air Defense Identification Zone, which they're now putting up in the East China Sea, which is just basically an area just off the east coast there between China and Japan, where they are now demanding that that anyone who flies through that airspace identify themselves with the Chinese military and file their flight routes. And so far, we have seen some American airlines are apparently going to be complying with this, and some Japanese ones aren't. And there's already been some military flyovers of American aircraft, including B-52s, that they did not tell China about. So they're already defying this. So it is an interesting development. But in some ways, the fundamental hypocrisy of this is being displayed by the Chinese themselves. We had a Chinese Defense Ministry spokesman come out recently and say that this shouldn't be a surprise to anyone in the region, because Japan has had its own air defense identification zone since 1969. And China is now saying if Japan wants to file some sort of protest about this, well, they can do so, and maybe we'll respond to it in 44 years. So I think they're trying to call out the hypocrisy of this situation. To a certain extent, I think that's true, but still, this has to be seen as an escalation of what's been happening in the region, but not one that hasn't been predicted, not only by myself, but by everyone who's looking at this Asia-Pacific region, where we've seen in recent years the Asia-Pacific pivot of the Pentagon. They're definitely trying to make this into the next military theater, and this is just one of those stepping stones along that path.
So now China, we gave all these tax incentives for people to take their businesses to China, setting up the failure of the United States, gave them tax incentives to go elsewhere around the world. Wherever there's a poor country, you go and take your business there, and we will financially reward you. So we've taken away the money from this country. We are taxing them to the hilt. The people are being taxed here in this country to the hilt. We now have China starting to pull some strings. What do you think the impact will be of China saying, you know, we're going to pull back on our support of the dollar? We're buying our oil from Russia, from Iran, from wherever, Venezuela, and we're not going to recognize the U.S. as the reserve dollar. What is going to be the result of this?
In the long run, if all things remain equal, I think this will be ultimately the demise of the dollar as the world reserve currency. And I don't see that happening in the near future, as some analysts predict. I think this is a long-term thing, but this is something that we can see that is happening right now, that the dollar is beginning to die its death by a thousand cuts, coming from China, which of course is one of the most economically active countries in the world, one of the biggest exporters of various products, is doing all of its bilateral deals with so many of its different trading partners in local currencies now instead of in the U.S. dollar. And that is starting to have an effect. And we have seen in recent years the Chinese have been arguing pretty strenuously that they should be included in a basket of currencies that underlie the IMF's special drawing rights, which is a kind of international settlement currency that that only central banks use, but is still kind of seen as perhaps the potential basis for the next world reserve currency. And China has been arguing pretty strenuously that the Chinese yuan should be part of that basket, and they've been making moves to make that happen, including making the Chinese yuan convertible into other currencies, which is happening in the Shanghai special economic zone, where they're kind of trying out some of these ideas. So they are making moves towards that, and I think in the long run that will ultimately mean the end of the U.S. world reserve currency status. And that is, I mean, that's pretty interesting given some of the other problems that are happening in other parts of the world, including the fact that, as I've mentioned before, I think on this broadcast and certainly in some of my other work, that China has recently become the world's largest importer of oil, overtaking the U.S., and is now projected within the next few years to be importing something like 70% of the world's oil exports, which is a pretty staggering figure. So we are seeing China again is becoming this behemoth. And whether they want to or not, I think they're going to have to start engaging more geopolitically. It's just the nature of the game that's played with these types of transactions. So they're definitely angling to become part of the new economic infrastructure, the world order, as it were. And America is basically dying the death of a thousand cuts against their currency.
But it seems that if the United States is in fact having the dollar threatened, and in fact if China is thinking of having the yuan and they're thinking of having it backed in gold, then why are we looking at a drop in gold that is just sort of like unprecedented over the past several years? And we're down, you know, 1250 right now to 1237. Why is this? You would think gold would be skyrocketing right now.
You would, if all things being equal made sense, but they clearly don't. I think the conventional wisdom that you'd hear from the talking heads is that, well, gold has basically had an incredible run over the past decade and a half, but that's over now, and we've entered an era in which the U.S. dollar is once again sound and is improving, and that there basically the idea would be that that because the taper, the quantitative easing taper, didn't happen this year, that means that the dollar is stronger than people were expecting, and that has cut into gold expectations, blah, blah, blah. But I think we can more accurately put this down to such things as the mysterious amounts of shorts that flooded the market right before that precipitous drop that we saw in gold prices back in April, and that has still never really been explained. We saw a huge number of shorts coming onto the market in the morning that that dropped the gold price down below market expectations and got all of the bots and traders to kick in and start selling. And that caused that rout that we saw that took a few hundred dollars off of gold in a couple of days. And gold has never really recovered from that. And we've seen it basically trending downwards throughout most of the year. And I think we have to put it up to manipulation in a number of respects. And in fact, I mean, just to bolster that argument, just today I saw an interesting article about some meeting minutes that Henry Kissinger was having back when he was in the White House in 1974. Henry Kissinger staff meeting minutes is online. You can go and read it for yourself, where they're talking about the need to manipulate gold price and the need to keep it down low in order to maintain the U.S. dollar hegemony. And this was back in 1974. I mean, they were openly talking about this in meeting minutes that you can actually download from government website right now. So the idea that anything has fundamentally changed in that picture in the last 40 years, I think, would be naive. We're still in that same situation today. They still want the dollar to be the dominant world currency for the time being. And in order to do so, they have to downplay gold. And we see all sorts of manipulations that happen as a result of that. And I think that's ultimately what we can chalk the gold's performance this year down to.
Well, do you think it's going to continue to take a downturn? You know, when Goldman Sachs comes out and speaks, then you know that they're trying to predict something. Like, they predicted gold was going to drop to 1400. Well, guess what? Gold dropped to 1400. Now Goldman Sachs says it's going to drop to, what is it, 1050 or 1150? I can't recall. You know, it seems that they seem to have these people that can predict what's going to take place in the future, or is that because they create the future?
Well, yes. I mean, that's a pretty good question. And the problem, really, when you're dealing with something like Goldman Sachs is, yes, they do have these forward guidance and they do give advice to investors. And sometimes they are eerily correct, as with, for example, their gold call earlier this year. But then other times they tend to be quite wrong, and wrong in a way that's surprising. So, of course, we can turn back to the housing bubble and how they were basically selling these ridiculous instruments that we now know were completely faulty, the mortgage-backed securities and the like, at the same time as they were betting against them secretly behind their customers' backs and using expletives that I can't use on air to talk about their customers in internal company emails that have since come to light. So we know that they do play this game where they try to game investors. So with Goldman Sachs forward guidance, you never know if they're telling the truth or if they're just trying to sell people a load of lies. And on that note, they've started coming out with their quote-unquote top trades of 2014. So people can be following that on ZeroHedge.com, where I'm following it as they're releasing them bit by bit. For example, they're long S&P. They've got a 2250 target for 2014. They're short the Australian dollar, etc. So to come back to the question, can we see this continuing with the gold manipulation? Is it going to continue into the new year? I think certainly for the next few months, I don't think there's going to be a fundamental change coming in gold prices. But the question is when and if this breaks out and how it's going to break out. I think it's interesting to put this against what's happening with Bitcoin right now. And of course, we've seen Bitcoin now flirting with actually being on par with gold, ounce per Bitcoin. So it's a pretty interesting
crossover. Let's talk about that when we come back. Okay, we'll talk about Bitcoin versus gold. A lot of recommendations that people move from gold into Bitcoin. Is that smart? We'll be back after this 4-minute break with James Corbett. Stay tuned to the Power Hour. This is Troy Schreiner. Welcome back to Power Hour. Thank you for joining us. It is 24 minutes after the hour. We thank you for being part of the Power Hour today and learning and going out and talking about what you learn. We're joined by James Corbett, thecorbettreport.com and internationalforecaster.com. And I'm going to allow you. We're going to take your phone calls today. At about 20 of, you can start getting your phone calls in if you would like to ask James Corbett a question on anything. He is so well-versed on so many things, and I kind of keep him to myself. I apologize for that. So I'm going to open the lines up at about 20 of so that you can get your questions in on anything financial or anything otherwise at 855-995-6923, 855-995-6923. Okay, if a person was coming into the financial world now and didn't know anything about it, and they hear this thing called Bitcoin, tell me, please, the who, what, where, when, and why. What is a Bitcoin, please, James?
Well, if you want the short version, it's an open source peer-to-peer cryptocurrency, which might not make a lot of sense to a lot of people out there.
Oh, so. Now I understand.
So let's break that down a little. Open source refers to the fact that this is an open source protocol that operates this cryptocurrency. And a cryptocurrency is in this case, it's an online currency in which there is an anonymity of transaction, by which basically, when you have a Bitcoin wallet, a wallet is associated with an account number, but that account number isn't necessarily associated with you. And so there's at least the possibility of anonymity when you're using Bitcoin. And basically, all Bitcoin is, at the end of the day, is a ledger of transactions. People have Bitcoins, which they mine digitally. Basically, it's a computer algorithm that works on solving basically complicated puzzles, mathematical puzzles. And when your computer contributes to solving one of those, it gets rewarded with some Bitcoin. So, and those puzzles.
Are you serious?
That's how
there's some kind of computer game associated with this?
Pretty much. I mean, I guess you could look at it that way. This is the way that the Bitcoins are generated, but it's already baked into the cake that only 21 million Bitcoin will ever be created. That's already part of the program. So there's already, I think, over 12 million that have been created. So now there's a dwindling supply left, and it's becoming more and more difficult to quote-unquote mine these Bitcoin. So what you have is people devoting more and more and more computing power to trying to solve this. And so now it's gone beyond the point of being sort of a hobby for computer geeks and into the point where people are investing massive amounts of money in the type of computing power that's necessary to mine these Bitcoin. So that's how they're created, quote unquote. But then, of course, they can be traded around. And that's how most people get into this, is by buying the Bitcoin on an exchange using their Federal Reserve notes or their other types of nationally branded funny money. And so this is how people get into the game. And then you can trade it like any other currency, except for the fact that because this is really just an online ledger, and all it is a decentralized network, a peer-to-peer network, where people basically transmit details about their payments to this ledger that's kept in everyone has this ledger in their computers, and they download and update constantly. And so basically you can facilitate a transaction that gets recorded to the big register that is Bitcoin, and people can see that this account traded with that account, but no one knows who's associated with what account, or at least theoretically so that's how it works. And the reason why this is so popular, or at least one of the reasons why people are such converts to it, is because at this point it's still in some ways circumvents regulations that would otherwise apply to regular currency transfers. So you can transfer bitcoins to other people for virtually no cost, and as opposed to pretty much any other way of trying to transfer money, especially across international boundaries. And of course, it also brings some anonymity. So it's been associated with some rather dodgy black markets online. And so this is kind of what's fueled the rise of Bitcoin up till this point. But in the last month, obviously, we've just seen it take off to the stratosphere, and as I say, flirting with the point of actually crossing over the value of gold, where one Bitcoin would be worth over an ounce of gold, which is pretty amazing, considering this was
trading. Whoa, say that again.
We are now flirting with the point where a one Bitcoin is worth an ounce of gold. It crossed, I believe, $1,240 for a Bitcoin the other day. I think it's back down below 1,000 right now, but still, it's flirting with that number. So it's a pretty, I mean, and that's basically happened in the past month. I can't remember what it was trading out a month ago, but it was, I think, only a few hundred dollars. Now it's up to about $1,200. And this has happened for a couple of reasons. One of them being that basically Bernanke and the Federal Reserve crew have said that they're now taking Bitcoin seriously as a currency. Also, China is getting into the game, and a big Chinese Bitcoin exchange just opened up. So Chinese money is flooding into the system now. So it's getting serious, and it's not quite a joke anymore.
All right, we'll be back after this 3-minute break. I still don't get it, but I got some more questions on Bitcoin. We'll be back 3 minutes. Stay tuned to the Power Hour. Joyce Riley. Welcome back to the Power Hour. Thank you for joining us. It's all about the truth. Well, it's all about the Bitcoin right now. We're talking about Bitcoin with James Corbett, CorbettReport.com. I still don't get this. Okay, the Bitcoin is a form of currency. It's a cryptocurrency, and it is being traded now as if it were money, more than the price of gold. And yet this is legal. I mean, help me understand, since, you know, the Liberty Dollar, they got trashed and stormed in their place because they were having another form of currency, which was actually gold and silver. And yet now we can have a cryptocurrency, a computer currency. I don't get it. I really don't get it, how they're able to do this, James.
Well, as long as people are keeping their keeping their money in Bitcoin and facilitating exchanges as Bitcoin to Bitcoin, then it really is its own beast, and it's more difficult for federal agencies to regulate. The choke point for this is the exchanges, where people exchange Bitcoin into dollars or dollars into Bitcoin or whatever currency it may be. That's where all these regulations and things start to kick in, and anti-money laundering legislation and things that say you have to clear transactions over $10,000 with special limitations and et cetera, all of that kicks in at that point. So when people are putting money into Bitcoin or taking it out of Bitcoin is where those types of regulations are traditionally choking the markets. But when it's just Bitcoin to Bitcoin, all it is really is just some bits and bytes traveling through the internet, and there's no way of really regulating that, especially because Bitcoin accounts aren't necessarily associated with a person. So there's no way to really regulate that, or at least they haven't thought of one yet. But I'm sure they are working on it. So that's part of the appeal of the currency, is that as long as you're doing Bitcoin to Bitcoin type exchanges, it's really difficult to even track, let alone control. But of course, again, as I say, the real choke points is where people are trying to take their money in or out of Bitcoin. And that's where a lot of this legislation does kick in. And now the Federal Reserve is studying it, and they are starting to look into how and if and when and why they should regulate the currency. So we're starting to see it becoming taken more seriously at the federal level, at any rate.
What is going to be the implication of this? Are we going to have a Bitcoin world? Are we going to be transferring over to Bitcoins? Do you think this is going to take over in business? Is this going to be a barter system? What is this eventually, where are they eventually headed with this?
I think we are going to see the normalization of Bitcoin more so than what we've seen today. We're already starting to see businesses starting to get in on it and starting to accept them. We're starting to see things like in Vancouver, the world's first Bitcoin ATM just opened, so people can get actual cash out of their Bit wallet through an ATM, or they can put money into Bitcoin through that, which did $100,000 of business in its first day. And that's just one ATM at a cafe in Vancouver. So there's a lot of interest, and that's obviously going to spark the adoption of Bitcoin in a lot of different businesses and things. And that's, I think, the real key to Bitcoin becoming something more than just kind of this online fad or this speculative investment. At this point, it's still extremely difficult to use your Bitcoins. I mean, you can find places to do it, but it's still a bit of work to do so. At the point where this starts to become a regular, everyday kind of thing is the point where I think this will be more seriously a currency, quote unquote. But there are certainly the Bitcoin evangelists out there who say this is the savior of humanity and is going to change the world for the better. There are the Bitcoin haters out there who say this is the work of the devil and it's the first step towards getting the chips in our wrists and that kind of thing. I don't think it's either, really, at the end of the day. I think it's just another possible way of circumventing the US dollar and the Federal Reserve tyranny, but just one of many, many different ideas out there. And even in terms of online virtual currencies, it's starting to have more and more competitors, as you would expect. Things like Litecoin and Quark and all of these other types of currencies are coming along now, which will eat into the Bitcoin market to some extent. So I'm not exactly losing my mind over Bitcoin at this point, either way, either in terms of it being the savior or being the devil.
All right, let me ask you this. What is it that has generated such an interest in the Bitcoin to make it more valuable than gold? I mean, at least you walk away with something when you have an ounce of gold. You walk away with something, or several ounces of silver. But what do you walk away with that gives such integrity to the Bitcoin?
It's a good question, and I couldn't answer it because personally, I don't think I would value a Bitcoin at $1,200. But ultimately, Bitcoin or any other type of asset, I mean, whether it be gold or anything else, is worth whatever people will pay for it. And we see that, I mean, if it's quite obviously a truism. If you're willing to pay $1,200 for an ounce of gold, then gold is worth $1,200 an ounce. If you're willing to pay $1,200 for a Bitcoin, then a Bitcoin is worth $1,200. And that's how the price of Bitcoin is pegged. Basically, they look at the exchanges where people are buying and selling Bitcoin, and they just look at what people are willing to pay, and that's what the price of Bitcoin is. I think that ultimately what's driving this at this point is speculative frenzy. I mean, this is a speculative bubble, obviously, I think, at this point, because there's not a lot underlying it. As I say, it's not even a very useful currency at this point in terms of using it in your everyday life. It's really mostly an online thing at this point. But as I say, there's been a couple of things that have happened over the past month, including the Federal Reserve coming out saying they're taking it seriously as a potential currency, or the U.S. Treasury is studying it. And we've seen the Chinese Bitcoin exchange open up and Chinese money flooding into the system. So there are reasons that that it's becoming more popular, but it is a speculative bubble at this point. It's not really, I think, justified by what we've seen over the past month to see it quadruple or quintuple in value in the space of a few weeks. And I think that the other part of this is, well, if this is speculative frenzy, then when will the party end? And Michael Rozef of the University of Buffalo had a very interesting article. If people want to look it up online, it's called Two Bits on Bitcoin's Price Chart Suggests Sell. And he was writing when the price was over $1,140. And he was saying that basically, if you look at it from a technical perspective, just looking at the charts, it has reached a top, at least at this point in its rise. And after he wrote that, at the end of the day of him writing that article, it was back down to $1,000. So I think there are reasons to say that the run-up that we've seen over the past month is over, and people probably shouldn't be buying in at this point. But hey, I've been wrong before. I could be wrong about this. So don't take
my
word for
it. You're so well-versed in all of this. I'm going to ask you one question here, and then I'm going to go to the phone calls, and then I want to talk about your trip to France. Let me ask the James Corbett a question. If you could have two shares of Apple, one Bitcoin, or 1 ounce of gold, what would you take right now? If I were going to give you one of your choice.
Good question. I definitely wouldn't take the Apple, if only on principle, let alone what I think about the company's expectations. And because obviously of the terrible things that they do and their collusion with the NSA.
Okay, but no principle, no morals involved. No principle, no morals involved.
If I was just being Machiavellian about it. Well, I still don't think I would take Apple. I don't think they have a lot of upside because of some of their, I think they've underperformed expectations quite a bit recently. And I think they will start to fall from where they have been over the past decade. So I wouldn't take the Apple. Bitcoin, I think, honestly, I think it has reached the top, at least in this run-up. I think it probably still does have further to go in the future if all things being equal. I would take the gold right now. Even though gold may still fall from where it is right now, I think in the long term, it has nowhere to go up but up. And I still believe that. So I would still be taking the ounce of gold.
Okay. Appreciate your answering that. All right, let's go to some callers. They are jammed wanting to talk to you. Bill in Texas. I believe it's Bill in Texas. You're up first. You are on with James Corbett. Go ahead, please, Bill. Do we have Bill in Texas?
The deal of the Glass-Steagall Act, which, of course, was the firewall between investment banks and deposit banks. My discount broker advised me a little over a year ago that they were now also a bank. And I have shares in their street name, and I've had them listed with a company, so I get the annual reports. But what happens if that broker goes broke, collapses? Are those shares assets?
Okay, Bill, we kind of missed the first part of what you said, and I think I missed it anyway. Say that over again, please.
Yeah, I had a question about the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act, which was a firewall between investment banks and deposit banks. And my broker advised me, discount broker advised me a little over a year ago that they were now also a bank. And my concern was, if they collapse or go broke, what happens? Whose assets are those shares held in their street name?
Yes, I mean, that's a very good question. And this is difficult because the regulatory framework is being worked out at an international level and then implemented at a national level. So there's different stages of implementation. I can't say specifically right now in the United States which tier of capital that would be classed as and how that would be dealt with. But I do know that in recent years, they have been putting out white papers at the international level through the Bank of International Settlements, saying that in the event of bank collapses, which this would now count as your broker is now a banker, they can take all of the assets and count them as basically going against whatever bankruptcy proceedings, so that they can actually take whatever deposits you might have, and since your investments would now be deposits, they can confiscate at least a certain percentage of them. That's where they're going to. At what stage of the regulatory process this is in the United States, I wouldn't know that off the top of my head, but I would have a lot of reason for concern about that process and what that's doing to people's savings.
Okay, does that answer your question, Bill?
Yeah, that underscores the concern I already have.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much for the phone call. Let's go to Mike in Tennessee. Mike, you're on the air. Go ahead, please, with James Corbett.
You there?
Yep, go ahead, please, Mike. You're on the air, Mike.
Quick observation and a good and a bad news. Quick observation. Number one, the Bitcoin to me is like tokens in an amusement park. Depending on the size of the amusement park will determine how much usefulness they have. The fiat currency we're currently using is no different than the Bitcoin. It is a fiat currency, the Federal Reserve Note. good news and bad news. The good news is that China has about $3 trillion in United States debt, but it's not dollars as they keep talking about. It's U.S. Treasuries. So when they convert those U.S. Treasuries, they're going to change the value of them, which will force the dollar up so that they can buy the properties in Detroit so they can build in brand new facilities to take all the raw materials to build the goods and services that they want to sell us here in this country. And of course, all those, what is it, 6-to-1 Chinese men, they're looking for women. They don't have any in China. Boom, Betty Boop's looking for Hung Wei Lo, and he's got a job. And there you go.
Wow. James, do you agree or disagree with Mike?
Well, he is right. I mean, when and if the Chinese use their nuclear option and start selling off their treasuries, that is going to push the dollar down. It's going to be a prime buying opportunity for the Chinese with all of their dollars to go and start buying up real estate. And we've already seen them starting to do that. In fact, Chase Manhattan's prime New York location was just bought for $750 million by a Chinese state-owned company. So we're already starting to see that process.
Interesting. Thank you very much, Mike. Good comments that you made. Let's go. By the way, the stock market opened. It's 30 in the red. Nolan in Texas, you're on the air with James Corbett. Go ahead, please.
I'd like to thank Mike for a very cogent and really intelligent observation.
Yes, absolutely.
And I hope that my position is also in keeping with his. Look, here's what I'm seeing. We're not ready to attack this Bitcoin. And this concept that, gee, all this stuff's just online and nobody really knows who's doing what. It's all very vague. But we have the Utah installation. We have all of the NSA spy work to believe that the government doesn't know exactly who's doing the Bitcoins is a little naive, in my opinion. I see all of this as they're allowing this to happen in hopes that those people, the average Joe investor who has bought the paper gold, that they will sell their paper gold and buy into these Bitcoins, and they're going to let this Bitcoin market grow and grow and grow until hopefully they sucker in some of the smaller real gold holders and get the genuine gold back out on the market and drive that price down, where the global elite will take that opportunity to pull in as much real gold as they can. Then they'll attack this thing and kill it, and they will have destroyed people's personal finances, which they want to do, and they will have absconded with gold, which they want to do. And that's what I see coming. Tell me where I'm wrong.
Well, let's see. James, what are your thoughts?
Well, I definitely share your reservations, and I see exactly what you're saying as a potential scenario, but I'll one-up you. What if they do exactly what you're saying and yet don't destroy Bitcoin? What if they keep using Bitcoin? Because as you say, the idea of online anonymity is a pipe dream, and people who believe that their Bitcoin accounts really aren't associated with them when the NSA is recording all the data that's flowing through the internet pipes is, I think, a bit of a naive thing. So maybe they want Bitcoin to take over as a new type of world currency. I mean, that's one potential scenario at any rate. And whichever way it goes, I do share your skepticism and your concerns. And I think that ultimately this probably is targeted at getting more people out of their paper gold and into Bitcoin. And I think both of them really aren't worth the paper they're not written on.
All right. Thank you very much for the phone call, Nolan. Let's go to Peter in Pennsylvania. Peter, you're on the air. Go ahead, please. I cannot think of anybody that would, in their right mind, want to invest $1,200 in something they can't see, feel, hear, get a record of, or know anything about. That amazes me. That really amazes me. And
To be fair, people were saying that back in April when it was $200 a Bitcoin, and people who bought in at that point have made 600% gain on investment in the last 5 months, 6 months. So,
upside,
but it's a question of when you get out, I guess.
Well, but what happens if they say all of a sudden this thing is illegal? It is, I don't know, whatever rules it violates, or all the money now goes to the government. I mean, you have no control in this. You have no, I don't know. Oh, let's go to Peter in PA. Peter, help me out. Go ahead, please, Peter.
Good morning. This is a little off subject, but I just would not hate to see the day go by without having James Corbett address the TPP in whatever fashion he would like. And I'll listen offline.
Great. Whoa, we need to talk about them.
Yes. Well, thank you for the opportunity. It is an exceptionally important thing that is flying under the radar to a large extent, even in the alternative media. So I'm glad for the opportunity. The TPP is the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement that that people may not know about. But basically, this has been referred to as NAFTA on steroids. And it's a trade agreement that's now being hammered out between 10 countries in the Asia-Pacific region in the Pacific. I'm sorry, 12 countries in the Pacific Rim now, including Japan, the United States, Malaysia. I mean, you name it. They're in on this. And this is going to be a giant free trade agreement that's going to lower tariffs and facilitate trade and blah, 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 all the stuff they usually say about these things. But exactly like NAFTA taking and bleeding out a lot of the manufacturing capacity of the United States, this is going to do it tenfold, I think, when we start putting in all of these developing Pacific nations into the mix. And this isn't going to be good for anyone because, of course, it's always about lowering the standards across the board, whether that be intellectual property standards so that that people basically have to pay exorbitant amounts for medicine, or whether that's intellectual property rights online so that people can't facilitate internet exchanges of copyrighted, quote-unquote, information and the like. It's a nightmare
right,
on wheels.
We got to go to this break. We'll be back after this three-minute break with the James Corbett. What an honor to have him on the show. We'll be back 3 minutes. Joyce Riley here. Welcome back to Power Hour. Thank you for joining us. It is 50 minutes after the hour, 54 minutes after the hour, wherever you're sitting. Stock market has dropped a little bit more. Gold is still at 1235. Silver is down 30 cents. And what's going on in the market, I'm not really sure. But of course, we're going to quit paying out all those bailouts, it seems like, and maybe that's affecting the market. I don't know. I want to talk with James Corbett about his trip to France. You said you attended a seminar. You spoke on open source investigation. Talk to us. Open source communication. Talk to us about what happened there.
Absolutely. Well, I was in Lille, France, just last week, 2 weeks ago, how time flies, talking to an open source conference called FOSSA. It's put on by a technical institute in France called INRIA. And every year they try to look at open source, which is traditionally associated with software. Basically, the idea that you can look under the hood, so to speak, and you can see the source code of a computer program, and you can contribute to it, you can change it, you can do what you like with the program. But they're trying to expand the meaning of open source beyond just software and talking about different things. So they were talking about open source art, and I was talking about open source journalism. And basically, this is the idea that journalism in this day and age, especially online, can link to all of the sources that the journalists use in their story. So instead of talking about a new law that the government's thinking of passing and just talking about it, you can actually link to it. So people who want to can actually go and read the law for themselves. This shouldn't be a particularly difficult thing to do or a particular breakthrough. But when you look at the mainstream dinosaurs, or media, it really is light years beyond what they're doing. So I was talking about that and basically the benefits of that. And again, that's up on my YouTube site for anyone who's interested, the results of that. And I think it was really interesting. I mean, it was really good to be there and to have that mix of people talking about software and hardware and people talking about art and people talking about journalism. There's someone who's building an open source car that you can literally download the blueprint for. You can order a kit online that you can put together a car by yourself, and their record is they had two people put it together in 41 minutes. It's a roadworthy vehicle that you put together.
Are you serious?
I am serious. It is amazing some of the things that people are doing out there. So it's good to be there and to see that and interact with some of these people, so you get kind of a handle of where things are. Because otherwise, I mean, there's not a lot of media that's reporting on breakthroughs like this.
Wow, that is incredible. That is incredible. Sure, they're not recording, you know, talking about that. Just like Iceland just gave a 13% reduction in people's mortgage values because they wanted to do the right thing by their people. I mean, how un-American is that? Let's go to John in Ohio. By the way, I got an email from Michael who says that there was a man who threw away a hard drive that had 7,500 bitcoins on it worth $7.5 million. That would kind of ruin your day, wouldn't it? Let's go to John in Ohio. John, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I'd like to recommend a blog called LandDestroyerBlogspot.com. I think maybe the guest, James, is familiar with it. And it had an article, I'm trying to remember the name, I think it's Washington's B-52 Diplomacy, and it points out what the corporate media is really censoring, because it points out that for centuries those Diaoyu islands supposedly disputed were always considered part of China, and even after the Second World War, the United Nations recognized that. But since that time, the United States has been trying to encourage Japan to take a claim to those things. So I think we're going to be in a stage now of a lot of demonization of China and reversing who's really responsible for the aggression. And that, I think, springs from Project for a New American Century, the neocon military-industrial document of 2000 that said that the United States intended to attack all countries around the world that disobeyed, Washington, essentially. Ultimately, countries that were allied with Russia and China, and those two countries being the ultimate target of all these wars.
Okay, we got to go to break. Thank you very much, John, for the phone call. Thank you. 58 minutes after the hour, we'll be back, and we'll get James Corbett's response to this. Yeah, we're going to destroy all countries that don't go according to the central banks' also desires. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with you. Welcome back to Power Hour. Thank you for joining us. It's all about the truth, and the truth you're not going to hear on television. You're not hearing any of this. None of this on television. I thank you so much for joining us, and especially our guest today, James Corbett, who gives his time to help us understand what's happening in the world. Let me go back to John's question here, or his issue over China. Are we trying to vilify China, and for what reason? Your thoughts, James?
Well, I have to agree. I think there is now the concerted effort to make China into the boogeyman of the 21st century, like the Soviet Union was of the 20th century. And in both cases, I think they were both supported by the monopoly capitalists who are really ruling this system in the United States and elsewhere, the banksters at the top of the pyramid. So I think it is a lot of smoke and mirrors. He points to Land Destroyer Report. I'd just like to echo that. It's an excellent website run by Tony Cartolucci in Thailand. Keeps a very good eye on a lot of different geopolitical issues. And with regards to these islands specifically that are now kind of the flashpoint between China and Japan, they're called the Senkaku Islands in Japanese. They're called Diaoyu in Chinese. The claims, China had claims on them before Japan and all of that. And people can look into the history of those claims. But ultimately, I don't think that's the real interesting part of this. The point that to me is, why are these uninhabited islands in the middle of the East China Sea suddenly this flashpoint? And I think the answer has to be in the fact that in 1968, there was an academic survey that was undertaken that found possible oil reserves in that area. So whoever owns the islands owns those oil reserves. And lo and behold, it was 3 years after that, in 1971, that China lodged its first formal claims to the islands in the modern era, at any rate. So I think we can see an obvious reason why these islands are suddenly a point of dispute. I think ultimately, no nation really owns some islands that are off its coast. I mean, I think this is just geopolitics and business as usual in the big geopolitical chessboard.
Well, yeah, it can be geopolitics and just, messing around. But it still can get really serious, though. I mean, there could be serious implications if too many planes go down because they didn't file the flight plans, et cetera.
Yes,
a lot behind this.
Absolutely. Just to be clear, I'm not saying that this isn't going to be a potential flashpoint or a potential sticking point. I'm just saying that the reason for this is a bit more cynical. It's not because China loves these islands so much. I mean, they are uninhabited.
Oh, okay.
But I think you're right. I mean, this is going to be at any rate an excuse to make China into the villain of the 21st century.
Got it. Okay, Johnny B in Missouri. Johnny B, you're on the air. Go ahead, please, with our guest James Corbett.
Hey guys, man, there's so many things I'd like to talk about, but I want to focus back in on Bitcoins.
Okay.
If all this stuff is involved electronically through the digital media, would that not ostracize the people that are either don't have the intellectual withdrawal to understand what's going on, or the ability to get on a computer? Because what I see here is the Rothschild banking family started out with him and his five sons, and then it's just slowly started growing up through France and then Germany and over in the United States. And what the big thing was to take the ownership
or take the ability of the local people to teach their children how to provide for their children. Am I being too...
Well, I don't know if that's true or not. This seems awful simplistic. Your response to that, James?
Well, with regards to the Bitcoin and the adoption of Bitcoin, I mean, you are right. I mean, it is an electronic currency, so there are kind of gimmicky things where people can buy a physical Bitcoin that is tied to an actual amount of Bitcoin that's in a wallet. But still, I mean, you can kind of do it offline if you really tried, but it's kind of difficult. I mean, you basically do need access to the internet, and I think that is one of the insidious parts of this, because it's wiring people further into this matrix that's really been created around us, even as all of these revelations are coming out about how the NSA is spying on everyone and watching everything you do online. Now we're getting even further ensconced in that matrix, and I think you're right. I mean, that's one of the worrying parts about the idea of this cashless society.
Thank you so very much. A lot of people concerned about this. I'm getting emails that don't like the idea of Bitcoin and think it does have something to do with scripture. Hey, thank you very much, James Corbett, for joining us in the Power Hour today. Most enlightening. We thank you so much.
Always a pleasure to be here. Looking forward to next time.
You have a blessed day. We'll be back. 3-minute break. Jerry Peterman and...